Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Do you have any more stories that you want to do now?
Do I have any more stories?
Extended stories. I'm just looking for a reason to go outside.
Oh, here's one.
I figure you can, you know, just kill time.
Here's one. Today is the first Meet Me on the Mile event. Michigan Avenue will be closed off for pedestrians. It's a free program. It's taking place by the water tower today. It just started. 9 o'clock and runs until 5.
What does that mean?
Meet me on the mile. You will be able to view antique cars from private collections. Huh. There's music, Tai Chi, a silent disco yoga class.
Oh,
that's for
I
us.
Love, I,
that's
one,
for us.
There's one thing I like
right
more
there.
Than doing Tai Chi in the street.
That
doing slow disco or whatever.
Silent
you said.
Disco
silent
yoga.
Silent.
Wait, silent disco.
Silent disco.
How's that possible?
Is that when you wear headphones?
I guess it is.
That's when you wear headphones and you dance to the beat of your own drum.
Right, yeah. And then there's a story hour with Cinderella.
Oh.
This runs until 5 o'clock today.
That sounds creepy.
So,
Cinderella's over there by that pile of spit on the sidewalk.
Michigan Avenue, today. It just started at 9 o'clock.
Nice.
And then also the...
What time is it over? Because we have
5 o'clock this afternoon.
Oh, we have a short...
We can go
today.
Over there at when the program's
go over,
over
there and have Cinderella tell us a story.
And
Cinderella telling the security, will you get those old guys away from here, please? Creeping me out. I thought the seven dwarfs were weird. These guys are even weirder. Well, that would be Snow White.
The State Street event is going on as well on the State Street Sunday afternoon event.
What's that?
Let's see here.
Any silent disco going on over there?
Oh, yeah. State between Lake and Monroe. Sundays on State. Closing State Street between Lake and Monroe.
Yeah.
That goes on all day today and into the early evening.
Hmm.
So you wanted reasons to go outside? There's two of them right
there. Well, I
wanted
to during the show, I meant.
Oh, you wanted during the show?
Yeah.
Well, we should have arranged for the kayaking show that we were been talking
it's
about.
It's a lot of fun. You should try it.
Yeah, Andy was involved with that.
Well, you know me. I love anything that disrupts traffic and makes it more difficult for people to get around and do their daily. It's my, we're coming up on, are they doing a marathon this year?
I think so, they are. Yeah. They are doing a marathon.
Okay.
You sound excited.
I love any time they close the streets and it's difficult to get around downtown.
Maybe we can get Sarah Ginger to pick us up and drop us off here.
On the helicopter.
With the helicopter. There you go.
I've been complaining about that for years.
And then you complained last year because you didn't have anything to complain about.
I know. Some people are just never happy, really. Franklin.
When my soul was in the lost and found.
One and only. You make me feel like a natural woman, the Carole King song. Because later on in the show today, we're going to be sharing my one-on-one interview with the woman that Aretha personally chose to play her in the movie of her life story, Chicago's very own Jennifer Hudson. That's going to be coming up later on. Did I ever tell you about the time I met Aretha Franklin?
Yes, you have... quite a
have I ever name dropped
eventually
name drop that
you have an interesting story at what took place during the interview.
I do so much name before. Dropping it's so hard for me to remember.
Who'd you say you were again?
So we're in the what's the casino in Hammond, Indiana? Horseshoe.
That's the Horseshoe Casino.
The Horseshoe Casino.
Yeah.
So she's performing at the Horseshoe Casino and I'm scheduled to interview her in her dressing room. And we go back into the dressing room, my cameraman and I, and there's Aretha Franklin just sitting there. And it's like...
She's by herself?
It's Aretha Franklin. Aretha Franklin.
Whoa.
I'm never nervous before I do interviews. Never. Once in a while. Dick Van Dyke.
I was going to say, you're
Sean
Dick Van
Connery.
Dyke.
The classics.
Yeah, sure.
And now Aretha Franklin. I'm like, hamina, hamina, ha, hamina, 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 ha. But she couldn't have been nicer, you know, putting everybody at ease in my camera, setting up the camera. And, you know, you have to get one of those little clip-on microphones, you know, and it clips on in the general cleavage area. That's where it hooks up. And my cameraman goes, Miss Franklin, would you like to pin this on? And she goes, oh, baby, just go ahead and put it on. Everybody's been down there. And then... you know, these microphones have like a little foam covering over it. It's called a windscreen, so your peas don't pop and like that. The windscreen falls in.
Oh, it was the windscreen.
The windscreen fell into the cleavage. And he like leans over. She hadn't noticed, and he like motions to me what happened. And I just shrugged my shoulders. I didn't know what to tell him to do. We never said anything. Presumably she found it later on. Presumably. But
the interview went well.
The interview
That interview.
It was fantastic.
Yeah.
And we have an abbreviated show today, and had we had a little more time, I would have we would have dug that out of the archives to play that for you today. But we are going to play our Jennifer Hudson interview, in which she talks about being chosen specifically by Aretha Franklin to play her in the movie Respect. It's getting pretty good reviews, fairly good reviews. I gave it a Dean's List B. So we'll talk more about that later on. But first, before we proceed, we have a very special presentation. Last week at this time, we were talking about how, you know, I stop into the newsroom almost every Sunday before the show just to say hi to Andy and Shwani and the whole crew back there, make sure everybody's sober. And I noticed that the bag, the paper bag that Shwani uses to bring his bakery products, his lunch, everything, was sitting on the counter there, all in tatters. And all scotch taped up.
It still is.
It looked like it went through World War II, this paper bag.
It's still here.
I think Churchill may have given this bag to Shwani's dad, and then it got passed down to Shwani. That's how nasty this bag looked. So
this got national attention, by the way.
Your bag?
Yes.
What do you mean?
I had friends in Los Angeles that were talking about this.
That's very nice. Good. I hope everybody gave you grief about it, because it was embarrassing.
I had to defend it
yeah.
On a video.
Well, here's the Shwani that we know and love. And after taking this beating last week, you still brought the paper bag in today.
Yes, you did. It's the official bag for Sunday morning.
And that is why Andy has a special presentation for you now.
Shwani, look at the monitor here.
Oh, look.
Andy. I have a brand new bag for you.
Brand new paper bag.
Never been used.
No tears, no scotch tape.
Yes, and what I'd like to suggest is, like at a baseball stadium, we retire the bag and we pin it somewhere noticeable in the newsroom.
Right.
This bag shall not be used again.
A place of honor.
Retired.
Okay.
Because honestly,
as they retire numbers at
correct
baseball.
Yeah. Right.
Because your paper bag really has lasted longer than many of the news anchors have.
And we're running out of scotch tape, so we got to get a new bag for you.
This is purely a financial reason that we're doing this. Our budget for scotch tape is topped out.
I bought a bunch of duct tape and electrical tape as well.
Yeah, people think he's kidding. He's not.
That is a beautiful bag.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
It's brand new.
That is just.
Did you pay 7 cents for that bag?
I think I may have even paid 10 cents for it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I was going to bring in one of those.
That's a surprise. You didn't say anything about
this. Of course not.
When you came in.
And you know what? Andy had it hidden under his shirt.
Under my jacket here, yeah.
You wouldn't, you know, I'm walking around, it's like, Andy looks, but like, what's up with Andy? Is he wearing a back brace under his shirt? Turns out it's the paperback that he brought in to surprise you.
Yep.
Well, I am touched. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
I meant to bring you like one of these nylon recyclable bags. That was my intention.
I have plenty of them, and I never use them.
Oh.
I can use this one.
You are one in a million.
Yes, right. He is.
You are one in a million. All right, we're going to get far-flung forecast in a couple of minutes here today. We've got Blue Man Group is going to be performing again. They just announced they're going to begin performances again next week. We're going to talk with a member of the Blue Men Group coming up on the program later on today. We've got the Jennifer Hudson interview that I had mentioned. We're going to share that with you. And also in a few minutes, Shawnee, in all seriousness, history is going on this morning as the Taliban retakes Afghanistan. Are they not on the verge right now of retaking Kabul?
They are in Kabul, and they are talking apparently with members of the Afghan government there that are trying to come up with some sort of an offer to them. We're continuing to follow this, but this happened much, much quicker than a lot of people thought.
I know.
And they've also taken over an air base where the Americans were once stationed, the Bagram Air Base, which also housed a prison. A couple thousand prisoners there from Taliban and the Islamic State group were held there.
Right.
But that is now in the hands of the Taliban.
Yeah, that is going on as we speak right now. So we're going to talk with Professor Tom Mikaitis from the History Department at DePaul, who is a bit of an expert on this region, a bit of an expert on Taliban. He will join us later on. We'll continue to bring you updates on all that's going on there.
Not to mention the weather that's going on in the southeast Gulf Coast there. The tropical storms. Fred has now strengthened to a tropical storm. We're watching Grace.
Yeah.
And over 300 people dead in Haiti as a result of the earthquake.
Earthquakes, yeah. And if in Afghanistan, we still have American personnel there waiting to be evacuated, right?
Yes, at the embassy. Dean, this reminds me of what happened in South Vietnam.
Yeah.
In 1975.
Yeah, those famous photographs of the helicopters and people hanging onto the helicopters.
President Biden has sent in now, once again, sending in troops there, and we are going to get a briefing later today from the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll keep you posted on the news events as they are happening, because after our 20-year involvement in Afghanistan, now that's ending. It's reverting back to the way it was when we went into Afghanistan 20 years ago. So I think it's more than an historic morning. So we'll keep everybody posted on all of that. And So let's move on then and bring you the most popular feature on the program, ladies and gentlemen. Much more popular than anything that any of us could do.
Yep.
And Andy or I, we just sit back, try to stay out of the wake that is the far-flung forecast. A weekly compendium of fascinating facts and figures presented to you by each week by Dave. He's too cheap to buy a new paper bag. Schwan.
Well, thank you again, and thank you for the wonderful gift.
You're very welcome,
Andy. That is a beautiful.
That's
beautiful
all, Andy.
Paper
I just wanted to know I had nothing to do with it.
That's a beautiful paper bag, and you know when I walk down the street with that, people won't recognize me now because it's in such good shape.
In Schwanee's neighborhood, he's known as the crazy Scotch tape guy.
Also, the bag man.
Yeah,
get it. The bag man.
I got you.
Okay. No. Well, at any rate, today our far-flung forecast takes us to Bethel, New York.
Bethel, New York,
which is a quiet town of about 4,200 people.
Would you say it's a sleepy hamlet?
I would say it's a sleepy hamlet,
okay.
Yes.
All right.
But on this date, 52 years ago, it was not so sleepy.
Oh, boy.
Because 52 years ago was the beginning of a music festival that was named for a town that did not want the music festival, Woodstock.
Huh.
52 years ago today in Bethel, New York, on Max Yasgur's farm, a 600-and-some-acre farm, Woodstock began on August 15th, 1969. The listing of the people here and the group still legendary. Janis Joplin, yep. Jimi Hendrix, yep. Sly and the Family Stone, right. Santana, yep. Jefferson Airplane. Yeah.
And you know what? In that incredible list of iconic rock figures, somebody explained to me how Sha-na-na got invited to that. Sha-na-na.
Sha-na-na was
that? What's that?
Creedence Clearwater Revival.
Oh, yeah. Sha-na. Oh, yeah. Rock and roll is here to stay. Oh, yeah.
Well, there's the line. Rock and roll was here to stay. This cemented it.
I know, but everybody else is... You know, like dangerous rock and roll.
Yes.
Sha-na-na.
Did you have the album?
I did.
The three record set?
Yes, I did.
Oh, I played that over and over and over again.
I did. Yes, I did.
Well, no rain in the forecast for Bethel, New York. Kind of a nice day to hold a rock and roll festival there. Sunny and 67, going up to a high of 77
maybe,
today in Bethel,
New York. I thought for sure you'd have some... highlights to play.
I don't have anything available. I'm sorry. I it would be tough to choose.
Maybe some of the chants?
No, I don't think we might would be able to air
we
those.
We haven't put our license in jeopardy in a long time.
Well, every Sunday morning that happens. But but no, I'm sorry. I don't have anything. I would love to play some the Santana Soul Sacrifice right. version from there.
I love the Jimi Hendrix.
And the Jimi Hendrix Star Spangled Banner.
That was incredible. I moved back when I was a kid. It's like, oh man, listen how he's playing the Star Spangled Banner. He's so far out.
Did your parents ever get to hear that record?
Yeah, I don't know how they could have avoided it.
I was told to turn it down repeatedly.
Yeah. On my pretend radio station that I had in my basement when I was then known as Dean Diamond.
Did you have an album show?
Dean Diamond.
Dean Diamond. Dean Diamond playing the hits for you, everybody. I would play the full album side.
Which one was your favorite?
Whichever had the Jimmy Hendrix.
That was side six.
I loved
that was side six for all you young broadcasters out there.
Yeah, man. For all you junior Dean Diamonds out there.
They saved Jimi Hendrix for last when they edited the three record set of Woodstock.
Yeah. What's a record, Uncle Dean?
What's a record?
Okay.
In a gatefold album, too, by the way.
I love when you make me feel old. Thanks.
You're quite welcome.
Is that it?
That's it. Sunny and 67 in Bethel, New York right now.
It's 9:36. And we have multiple music sources going on this morning. 9:36 Dean Richards Sunday morning on WGN. Time for our weekly visit with Dr. Kevin Most, Chief Medical Officer, Northwestern's Central DuPage Hospital. Good morning to you, Dr. Most.
Dean, good morning. How are you doing?
Doing very, very well. Happy to see more and more people wearing masks. Happy to see more and more places requiring vaccinations for people who are inside. So we can try to, you know, kind of get a hold on the Delta and Lambda variants, the variants that seem like they're out of control right now. How would you rate where we are with this right now? Are things getting under control? Do you think... we're still sort of in a state where we should be very concerned?
No, I still think we should be very concerned. I still think we haven't seen our peak of what's going to happen. Projections bring that to about the middle of October. And you look at states like Florida, you know, very discouraging about what's going on down there. And it's a microcosm that, you know, that's within a couple hour drive from us or a couple hour flight from us. So very concerned still.
Yeah, in the past few weeks, we had talked about Lollapalooza being a super spreader event, and the word came out this past week that it was not a super spreader event. I'm glad that I was wrong about that. Is that because it was outside, do you think? What do you think are the variables that contributed to that?
No, Dean, I'm not sure it wasn't a super spreader. You know, what they announced is they knew of 200 cases. Now, that means that everybody would have reported and told them that they had cases. They couldn't find the asymptomatic cases. I still think we're still in that window where we might see the impact of Lala. Plus, you have to remember where the word came out from the city of Chicago, which was very adamant that this was going to be a safe event, even though we knew statistically it couldn't or it may not be. So I'm not sure we're out of the woods yet. I still think that the impact of that is going to be felt as a ripple effect here over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, I'm not trying to rationalize, you know, trying to be right about that. And I trust your judgment and evaluation more than anyone's. The figures of which they released for the city of Chicago are cases that were reported in the city of Chicago. And, you know, a lot of the people, probably the majority of the people that come in for Lollapalooza come from elsewhere. Now, and I don't mean just the Chicago suburban area. I mean from really all over the world who come in for that giant music fest.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you hit it right on the head there. It's just that the numbers that they have is a subset of a population that was much bigger. So we know how contagious the Delta variant is. We know, you know, there were a lot of unvaccinated, as well as we know the impact of vaccinated people with Delta. So I'm not sure we're out of the woods yet. And like you said, it's very reassuring that you're starting to see more people being wise and wearing masks, even if they are vaccinated.
Yeah, I guess the big news this week was that the Food and Drug Administration authorized third doses of the Pfizer and Moderna coronavirus vaccines for immunocompromised people. Explain what all of that means and who is affected by that, please.
Yeah, it's really interesting the way that they announced it and the way that they're rolling it out. So they said, you know, this is going to be for immunocompromised patients who got either Pfizer or Moderna. They're excluding J&J at this point. So these are individuals who are cancer patients who got solid tissue transplants, so kidney transplant, heart transplants, patients that are on high-dose steroids for anti-rejection for transplants, as well as for other immunocompromised illnesses like rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, Crohn's disease. Now, the interesting thing is that no proof of illness has to be made, no prescription from a physician. So this is totally on the honor system as they're trying to get the word out to those who are immunocompromised that your immune response to the first vaccine, the first dose, two doses, may not be as great as we wanted it to be or as it was for healthy individuals.
So anybody could walk in and say, I'm immunocompromised. Give me another shot. It's like going into a bar.
Exactly right.
It's like going to a bar. Shots for everyone.
Yep. And I do. I think exactly. Shots. It'll be very interesting to see. You know, we look at this at about 2 to 3% of the population. It'll be interesting to see how many we actually give as that third dose. You'll have some that feel that they won't need it, but you'll have others that are going to say, you know what, I'm someone who gets a lot of colds. I feel I'm immunocompromised, mm-hmm. and they're going to get in line.
Yeah. This is different from the booster vaccines that we're wondering if we're all going to need at some point soon.
Yeah. You know, we have to remember that these individuals, for those people in the population who are healthy, when they got their first two shots, they got about 94-95% coverage. Immunocompromised, as they're looking back at the data now, find that it's closer to 60-70%. So really, this third shot is to get them up to where we are. As far as boosters, if you think back and if you listen to the tape of ours from, you know, a month ago, I was saying boosters, probably not for a year. I'm saying now, as you're listening to what's going on and the Delta spreading as fast as it is, it would not surprise me if we advance the boosters to seniors, to healthcare providers here very soon after we give a wave of immunocompromised, and then the general public sometime probably around New Year's, I would bet.
Wow. Now, does that also include people who have previously had COVID? Because we had talked about that as well, that people who survive COVID have a natural immunity on top of vaccination. Will they also need boosters? Will that be recommended, do you think?
It probably will, because I don't think they'll try to sort that out, because a lot of people who had COVID were asymptomatic, so their immune response may not have been very big at all. We know that those who were moderately ill and those who were hospitalized probably had a big immune response, so I don't think they're going to get down to sorting that out. But I think anybody that's out there right now that's listening that says, I'm not getting vaccinated because I had COVID, needs to understand that your immune response was nowhere near as strong as it would be if you get the vaccine. And we know that those who have had COVID and then got the vaccine, so essentially almost like a booster, had 10 times the response. So anybody who's had COVID and is saying, I don't need the vaccine because I had it, please get vaccinated. You're going to be in a much better position.
I want to get to as many calls as we possibly can, questions for Dr. Kevin Most, because we always run out of time, and I want to try to spend as much time as possible this week on that at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. But just before we go to that, I want to talk about another aspect of this, and that is the crush that this new wave of Delta and mostly Delta is putting on our healthcare system. I've heard and read so many stories this week of hospital systems around the country that are to the gills with patients and not able to treat other patients, non-COVID related problems, because they have so many people now who are coming in with COVID-19 and Delta.
Dean, it's interesting that you bring that up right now, because we see what's going on in Florida, Alabama, Louisiana, Texas, Georgia, you know, and then we compare to what's going on here. Many hospitals up here right now are full, and they're not full of Delta, or excuse me, of COVID patients. They're full of patients who may have delayed treatment previously over the last 18 months. We're playing catch up there. And then to get hit again with COVID, boy, you know, for my peers down in those southern states, my heart goes out to them, because they got beat up once, they got a very short reprieve, and they're getting beat up again. And you're stressing this healthcare system, especially in the South, to a breaking point where you're going to see nurses retiring, doctors retiring, and really nobody being able to fill the shifts that they need to care for those who are ill.
Well, that's the next point that I was going to make, is it's not only the healthcare system, it's the healthcare workers who were worked to death, in some cases literally, during the first wave, and now it's happening again, and they're still understaffed, you know, maybe even more so in many cases, because a lot of people did take retirement and didn't want to come back and deal with this again. So, I mean, you know, people who are now needing to go to the hospital for cancer, for non-COVID-related things, there's no room for people right now, and there's no staff to take care of them.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, when this first came out, healthcare workers, first responders, we were the heroes. We were taking care of all this. People don't understand that. We need to, again, go back and thank those nurses, thank those doctors who are doing this. They are being pushed to the brink again. And if you took anybody in any industry and said, you know what, for two and a half years, we are going to work you 10 times harder than you normally work, people would be saying, I'm getting out of that industry, I'm going somewhere else, or it's time for me, if I'm on the fence, to retire. And we would be devastated if we lose more healthcare workers. And it's not like it's a spigot that we can turn on. We can't all of a sudden say, you know, let's have 30% more nurses and 30% more doctors. It's not that easy. There's a lag delay, obviously, in education treatment. And we have to make it an attractive occupation again. So many nurses are saying, wow, I think people are thinking about, should I go into nursing? Boy, I don't know right now.
Yeah, it's tougher. It's always been tough, but even more difficult than it's ever been. Dr. Kevin Most, 312-981-7200.
Our son-in-law, he's had COVID, and because of that, he went to go get a test on his antibodies, and they told him that his antibodies were huge and through the roof, and he was very, very, very well protected, evidently. And therefore, he doesn't think he needs to get a vaccine, even though, you know, we read, yes, that if you've had COVID, it definitely backs you up even more for having the vaccine. But his argument would be his antibodies are already so high, and I haven't heard anybody really address that.
Yeah, Gene, when we look at the response from COVID, you know, individuals may have a poor response, a moderate response, a great response. But we know that natural immunity wanes. So that would be the reason that even though he has great T huge response right now, it would still be a recommendation to get the vaccine. He may say, you know what? No, I want to wait. What we're really telling people with who had COVID, don't go out and get antibody tested, because as we know, your antibodies can go very, very low and be undetectable, or they can be high and drop down to zero the next day. So that reassurance that I've had the illness has been proven to not be positive. Many more people who have had COVID are getting the reinfection than those who have had COVID, been vaccinated, and then not been reinfected. The science is out there for you.
All right.
Okay, that sounds good.
Good advice there, Gene. I appreciate your call. And this time we've got Susan. You are on WGN. Hello.
Hello, Dean. Yay, got the right line.
You may.
Hey, I had a question. My daughter-in-law is in, I think, her first trimester of pregnancy. Do you recommend that she gets the COVID shot?
Susan, 100%. And if you saw last week, not only did the FDA, CDC come out, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology reaffirmed that definitely these individuals should be vaccinated. An individual who is pregnant and gets COVID is in a very serious condition potentially for not only their own health, but their fetus's health. So their very strong recommendation came out last week. Do it, because we know that the side effects from the vaccine are way less dangerous or harmful to the mother as well as the fetus. I can't be strong enough about this one, that really the protection that this individual is going to get for themselves and their fetus certainly outweighs the discomfort or potential minor side effects from the vaccine.
Okay. Yeah, because we were talking the other night, and she really doesn't want to get it, but she says, you know, she don't know what would happen to the baby. But I said, might ask your doctor, and she hasn't been to the doctor yet. She has another appointment in 2 weeks. Excuse me. So I'll tell her that I talked to you, and you highly recommend it.
Yeah.
So, and I would bet when she's to see her obstetrician, he will be right behind saying the exact same thing.
Yeah. That's so important to talk to doctors. So many people are, you know, just going with their own opinions or what they read on the internet or what this group or that group is saying. Ask your doctor. I mean, if you're looking for some, you know, unless you've gone to medical school, you're probably not going to get as good information. 815 area code texts, Dr. Most, is the Moderna or Pfizer vaccine more effective against the Delta variant?
Wow, your listeners are right up to date. So a study came out later this past week, Thursday or Friday, if I'm not mistaken, that actually showed that Moderna is a little bit more protective against Delta over Pfizer. There are more breakthrough cases, and the Moderna appears to be slightly better. So we're watching the studies coming out of Israel right now as they are a little bit ahead of us for boosters. But it certainly seems like you get about a 10 to 20% more protective rate if you got Moderna over Pfizer for Delta only, not for the Alpha, but for Delta. But a great question and something we did notice a difference, which surprised many of us.
Now, might that change with boosters?
Absolutely. And because we have to remember, with the booster, you're going to be agnostic. You, if you had Pfizer, you can get Moderna. If you had Moderna, you can get Pfizer. So for the booster, it's going to be mixing vaccines is totally going to be permitted.
This is Cindy with Dr. Most on WGN. Hello. Cindy, hello? Are you there? Yes, hello.
Oh, yeah, hi, I didn't hear you.
That's
hi,
okay.
Good morning. I love you, both you guys.
Thank you.
We are invited to a rescheduled wedding from last year that was canceled, Labor Day weekend, probably indoors with a couple hundred people. We're both vaccinated with Moderna. Now we're not sure if we should go.
Yeah, Cindy, you know, we look at Labor Day weekend as only being a couple weeks away, and boy, how can things change as dramatically as they have? But if you just look at what's happened recently, you know, we're talking about doubling of cases. It's a tough call for me. I would say that wearing a mask would be appropriate. You don't know what the rest of the individuals are that are there. And we know that the Delta can spread so easily, especially if indoors. I would hope that they would take every opportunity to have it outdoors. But certainly at weddings, we congregate in small groups. We talk very closely and loud, which are perfect opportunities to spread the virus.
Yeah, and a younger crowd, for sure. You know.
Right. Right. Exactly.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, you make a very good point. You know, the 18 to 29 year olds often are the ones at weddings, even 30 to 39. All of those hit record high for hospitalizations this past week.
Yeah. Good luck with that, Cindy. I'm kind of facing the same thing myself, Dr. Most. The 1 year anniversary of my mom passing away is coming up in a few weeks. We never did have a memorial service because of COVID last year. We were thinking we'll certainly be in the clear for September of this year. And now I'm wondering if we should cancel and postpone again until things clear up a little more.
I'll tell you, this Delta has thrown us a curve, Dean. You know, if we would have had this conversation in May, which I'm sure we have in the past, saying, you know what, by September, are you kidding? Right. Vaccinations are going to continue to go up. We're going to have this in check. We'll be heading back towards somewhat normalcy. Now, I'll tell you, the uncertainty of what Delta is going to do as those cases from the southern states start to spread up to the north here, concerning it.
Yeah, that was exactly our scenario. In the spring, we thought we'll certainly be clear by September, October. And now, you know, a lot of older relatives and family friends are going to be there. We don't want to put anybody in jeopardy. So we'll see. Dr. Most, as always, we appreciate your time, your information. Dr. Kevin Most is the Chief Medical Officer, Northwestern's Central DuPage Hospital. Have a great Sunday, Kev. Thank you.
Take care, Dean. We'll talk soon.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome in to the program today. What we do on Sunday morning is report on the news, bring you your Sunday morning news, weather, sports, traffic. We try to have some fun when appropriate along the way, but when there are major news stories going on, we always dig into those as well. And certainly one of the biggest stories in the world this morning is the takeover of the capital of Afghanistan, Kabul, by the Taliban. Professor Tom Mikaitis is a professor of history at DePaul University. He is an expert in terrorism. He knows about the Taliban back and forth. On his Twitter account this morning, it reads, despite the U.S. having spent more than $2 trillion on Afghanistan during the 20-year war, the Taliban are poised to retake control. And Tom, first of all, welcome to the program. Nice to have you with us. But I mean, it seems as though they are in control of Kabul right now, right?
Well, they're consolidating their hold in the outskirts of the city. It's a fluid situation, but it's hard to know. But it's inevitable that they will control Kabul. I mean, the president apparently has already fled the country with his government. So, I mean, given that morale was already bad, that was certainly going to sink it even further.
Yeah. Are you surprised at the speed at which this has happened? Nobody is surprised, really, that the Taliban would get strongholds again after the U.S. departed. I don't think anybody thought that it was going to go this fast.
I am surprised by the speed, but as I dig into it, it's not difficult to understand why. What we don't realize is when President Trump entered into negotiations and announced that America was going to leave, and it was only a question of negotiating the end date, the Taliban put in place a very effective strategy that attracted very little attention outside the country. And that was they systematically began to reduce outposts in the countryside. It's almost, ironically, given that religiously they would hate Marxism, it's a very classic Maoist strategy, use the countryside to drown the cities. So that was happening on a fairly regular basis. And what people don't realize is by the time Biden took office, we were down to about 6,000 soldiers on the ground. And they were not carrying the fighting. Now, the air power and the promise of that, the threat of that, kept the Taliban in the background. But all they had to do is play a waiting game. And once we pulled out, they already had such extensive control. And in a country like this with very weak infrastructure, you are isolating the cities. And that's what they did. They also very brilliantly, I mean, I have to say, much as I can't stand them, concentrated not on their expanding out of their heartland in the south, but in cutting off the borders. Herat is in the west, typically Hazara territory, but it cuts off access to Iran. And Mazar-e-Sharif in the north was the route into Tajikistan. So essentially, they've simply isolated it and now systematically strangled it. And the other thing is the rampant corruption has hid the fact that this so-called strong army we left them is incredibly hollow.
The U.S.-trained Afghan troops, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, on paper, it looks very formidable. It's about 300,000 police and army. But estimates run as low as only about a sixth of that being actual fighting strength. Because what many of them are what are called ghost soldiers. They're on the payroll, so the local commander can take their money and maybe pay them to show up if there's an inspection or a drill or something like that. But they're not actually there to fight when they're needed. Most of the fighting has been done by a hardcore of extremely competent special forces. Numbers range anywhere from 10 to 50,000. It's hard to even get a firm fix on these things, who are just simply overextended and lacking support. They've done extremely well, but they simply are overwhelmed. And more, as government corruption is so transparent, people ask the same question any of us would ask. Is it really worth dying for this? And the answer they have is quite no. The other thing is we in a sense helped to create the problem because we gave them an American style army, heavily dependent on complex logistics and air power, which once that was not there to the degree that we provided, they simply are not functioning terribly well. I've talked to people who fought there, and they've said, both from the Canadian and the U.S. military, said one of the problems they had was anytime they ran even encountered minor resistance, the Afghan regulars would hunker down and wait for American helicopter gunships and ground attack aircraft. Mm. You have to ask yourself, if air power is so crucial, why are the Taliban winning without it?
What is the reaction to people who fought there with whom you have spoke about this categorical withdrawal? Do they feel we've wasted our time, money, and lives?
Well, I suspect there is some of that, and my heart goes out to them, and I thank them for their service. But I would remind everybody, and I think if you listen to some of the testimony they've made, you know, they understand this is the best of a series of very bad choices. But the problem is trying to argue that the only way to redeem the losses and the sacrifices of those who've died and been injured is to risk more is how we ended up with 50,000 plus dead in Southeast Asia. It becomes the gambler's phenomenon of the only way I can justify the loss is to try to recoup it. General Petraeus was on NPR the other day arguing, you know, exactly, oh, we need to go back in, we need to reestablish control. But then he also said this war is not winnable. All we can do is manage it. Well, under those sort of circumstances, we could be having this conversation in 5, 10, 15, or another 20 years.
Yeah.
Are we really prepared to have a permanent presence in Afghanistan? And how many more American lives and how much money are we willing to continue to lose on this place?
So what do you think will be the change once the Taliban takes over completely in Afghanistan? What will it mean for the people there? And in particular, what will it mean for women there?
Well, first of all, the thing that has to be said, it's misleading to say the Taliban is going to take over. Ousting the government and exercising control are not the same things. This is a deeply divided country. It's ethnically divided. It's even religiously divided. And the Taliban itself is not monolithic. They were talking today about how there's a disconnect between the negotiators and the people on the ground. So, you know, the fact that they clear government forces out doesn't mean they necessarily have a firm hold. I think you're going to see months, if not longer, of civil war, as we did in the Afghan aftermath of the Soviet withdrawal. I am horrified and sickened by what Afghan women are going to go through in the areas the Taliban control. I'm not, as I said, this is a bad choice. But to go back in is going to require killing an awful lot of civilians because those are the people that are dying. Look at the casualties. They're disproportionately civilian.
We appreciate your insight and the information that you bring to all of this. Tom Akaitis, professor of history, terrorism expert, DePaul University. Appreciate you joining us today, Tom. Thank you so much.
Sure thing, Dean. Happy to do it. What's up?
Jennifer Hudson appearing on Late Night with Stephen Colbert the other night, promoting her new movie, Respect, in which she plays the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. Handpicked by Aretha to take on the role. It was 15 years ago that Jennifer won the Academy Award for her role in the movie Dreamgirls. She was then summoned by Aretha to come and meet with her, and Aretha told her that she wanted her to play her in this movie. Jennifer was in town here in her hometown of Chicago this past week, and I sat down with her one-on-one, and we talked about this very surreal moment.
Very surreal. That was when we had our initial meeting about me playing her. And imagine that, coming off the whirlwind of Dreamgirls and winning an Academy Award, and then I have to sit at the table with the Queen of Soul, and she says, you know, okay, this meeting is about me potentially playing her. And again, yes, that was 15 years ago.
Did she say why she chose you? I mean, there are so many people that would have liked to have played her, but she was had always been very insistent that you're the one.
You know what? I'm so upset at myself that I never even asked that question. Like, but I mean, just getting used to the idea of it is enough. A lot to take in, so maybe that's why. But no, and I feel like I've had to gather that reasoning for myself all along. You know, like, okay. But I think it's beyond, after now portraying her, like singing and acting, you know, that I discovered while filming. Like, it was so many different connections that I felt she saw that I wasn't even aware of.
Yeah. Did she give you any tips, any advice, anything through those years? Like, when you play me now, you know, make sure you do this or don't do that. Because I could see her.
That's very much how she she is. The one thing she said, now, I'm the Queen of Soul. And I'll say, yes, ma'am. I know. And also, making it clear, her voice is her voice.
Yeah.
Yours is yours, but use what your voice is. And to me, that's amazing because that's the underline of the film. To me, that's the message of the film, is her finding her voice. So she was always big about us, you owning your own voice. And that was one of the first things she said.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things that impressed me so much about your performance with this. I think partially because I've been around you so much through the years at WGN, at concerts. I know Jennifer's sound and style, and even the way you walk and the way you present yourself. And in this movie, I was like, she is doing everything like Aretha. She sounds like Aretha. She's walking like her. Her facial motions are like Aretha. I mean, you apparently did some studying to capture that essence, seems like to me, anyway.
Thank you. Yes, I said Aretha sent me back to music school, everything you can imagine, because she had so many layers to her. But it was very subtle. She didn't have, like, drastic mannerism and characteristics, so hers is very subtle. So a lot of it was in expressions, facial expressions, nothing too verbal. And it was, as an actor, the challenge, because I'm a very outspoken person that speaks verbally, you know what I mean, and express myself. As they say, I wear my heart on my sleeve. But Aretha was completely the opposite. She was more of an introvert. And one thing I told the people on the set, I was like, if I don't make you feel uncomfortable, then I'm not doing my job. Because she had a presence where you kind of didn't know what she was thinking. She didn't give much away. So I was like, how am I to channel that and tell this story from her perspective?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Did you, I mean, was it a different Did you have to kind of relearn to sing? Because it seemed like her, in some songs, her register is much lower than yours.
You know what she said in her life? She said, Jennifer has a very clear sound. And when she said that, I didn't understand. But once I worked with the dialect coach, Tom Jones, and we had to look at her instrument and how it was built, my instrument and how it was built, and we learned that they're built differently but can lend to the same things. So what we wanted, how we approached it is like, okay, using her nuances or her signature licks or her approach and how she sings. Apparently she sings from the top of her head. Well, I said, well, where do I sing from? He's like, well, you sing from the bottom of your feet, you know? So it was like kind of like blending the worlds in a way and then allowing her influence on me to come through.
As you were recreating moments from her life, was there a moment or, you know, something where you just felt like Aretha's spirit was with you, whether it was in her home, her actual home, or in the church, or someplace? Was there a moment where you just felt like Aretha's here right now with me?
I had several of those moments, and I still feel like I have those moments. You know, a lot of it for me, definitely in the church. A lot of the church scenes, and a lot of times when she had to lean on her faith, you know, stuff like that. And even within the line, certain things that were said I could hear her sing, or that was almost true to myself in ways as well. And it was a lot of those moments, but those were the things that also helped me tell the story.
Yeah. I was talking to Marlon Wayans, who is amazing.
He is so good.
Dramatic actor, blew me away.
Yes.
But all he could do was praise you.
Aww.
All he could do, as much as I wanted to compliment him, he just come back to talking about being at a Jennifer Hudson concert, singing Aretha songs every time. But, I mean, the dramatic scenes between you two are... They're going to surprise a lot of people.
Wow. He was amazing. He just came in and put it all out there, and he wanted to continue to raise the bar. So Raleigh cannot cut himself short, and he was always present. And I love his perspective on Ted. It's like, I don't want to play an abuser. It takes him to say it. I can't even put it into his words. But it should be a love story that leads to. So he had his own vision for the arc, and we just were able to like come together in that way to make it authentic, I think.
Yeah. They're wrapping it up here. Do you have any albums, anything coming up for you?
In the middle of this, in the midst of it all, I am currently working on my next album as well. And it's been madly influenced by, you know, all this whole experience of portraying Aretha Franklin, which has inspired my music. So I want to approach it in that way and dive into it.
All right, we'll catch up when that it's coming out.
Yes.
One of the greatest performances ever. Aretha Franklin at the Kennedy Center saluting Carole King for her song You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman, 2015. Fantastic. Getting ready to talk about theatrical performances reopening in Chicago. Some have already. Last week we told you about Kinky Boots reopening at the Paramount and Aurora. We're doing a safe Dean's Night Out. Vaccinations are required at the Paramount, but we're giving away some tickets for a group of listeners to join me to go see Kinky Boots safely. You get information at WGNradio.com/contest. But I am so excited that Blue Man Group is returning to the Chicago area at the beautiful Briar Street Theater. You know, it closed when everything else closed at the beginning of the pandemic. And now we are looking at Blue Man Group reopening. Mary Grisolano is the... let me see here. The managing director of Blue Man Group, former general manager of Blue Man Group here in Chicago. So, Mary, you've got a lot of history over at the Briar Street Theater, don't you?
I do. It's like a home away from home.
Yeah, I was trying to even remember what was at the Briar Street Theater before Blue Man, because it's been there for such a long, long time. I can't remember.
Oh, gosh. I know sometime before Pump Boys and Dinettes was there, and something with Lily Tomlin was there, but I don't remember either.
Yeah, it's been quite a while. I can't even imagine how excited you all must be to be reopening the doors, putting on the blue makeup again, and getting the show up and running again. Talk to me a little about that.
Oh, yeah. We're thrilled. We're thrilled. I feel like you don't realize how much you miss something until it's gone, right? So a year and a half without performing the shows and being on audiences really, or being in front of audiences, really makes you realize that's what it's all about. That's what a lot of us have made our lives, built our lives around, is doing theater. So the fact that we're in this moment where we're going to reopen, I'm coming to Chicago tomorrow, and I'm just thrilled to be back and to see the show. And we've got some new elements coming in, and people sort of were able to ruminate about the show during COVID. And when we came back, people had a lot of ideas of what they wanted to do. So I think it's good to be here in this moment.
Yeah. So I think first and foremost, what everyone is asking before they go to any public event is what kind of safety precautions are going to be taken, particularly with Delta variant and some of the setbacks that we've had in recovering from the pandemic. Blue Man Group has always been a very audience participation show.
Yeah.
How are you all going to deal with that?
Yeah, we're still talking about, because the Delta variant has every day we're thinking and rethinking and thinking and rethinking about our safety plans. So right now I can say there's a mask mandate, so everybody in the house and everybody on the show except for the Blue Men when they can't will be wearing masks, and then the Blue Men when they come into the audience will have face shields on. We've increased our cleaning standards. All of our employees are mandated, have been vaccinated. We have a vaccine mandate for our employees. We're going to paperless ticketing. The Blue Men's, any interaction with the Blue Men that formerly was particularly, I don't know how to say it, but I know you remember the show. There's a moment where they spit in someone's hand. Obviously, anything that's really not hygienic has been cut.
Right.
And we're doing everything we can to keep the interaction, but keep it safe and very thoughtful about the fact that we're hopefully coming out of the pandemic. Yeah.
I did notice when our Annabella Val on the TV morning show was there the other day. I did notice that the Blue Men in some cases had plastic shields in front of their faces, so you could still appreciate the blueness of it all. But
that's right.
But there was a plastic shield actually covering their eyes, nose, and mouth.
That's right. And you, I hope, remember having the makeup on. If you put a mask on over that, it could be unsafe because the way it could run and melt, it would be hard to breathe.
Right.
So.
Right.
It both aesthetically helps, but it's also not realistic that they could perform as active of a show with a mask on. But yeah, anytime they're with other people, they'll have the shield on.
Yeah, I actually have a picture of me when they made me a Blue Man. They put the makeup on me and with the makeup artist who the poor thing who had to do all of that. It's on my desk at home. I look at it every single day, and I wonder how we got all that blue makeup out of my shower when I finished. First of all, I drove home from the theater with most of it still on, but then showered and showered and showered trying to get all this blue makeup off of my face. It looked like a Smurf got murdered in my shower. And your performers do this every single day. It's not even a big deal for them, right?
That's right. I think they've got all the tricks down for putting it on and off quickly at this point. And they usually shower at the Briar Street, so it's our crew that has to clean up the bodies of the dead Smurfs every night.
right. So you mentioned that there are some new things. I mean, part of the fun of going to Blue Man, I know I've probably seen the show 6 or 8 times because, I would come when there were changes and things like that, but I would always bring friends and family because I wanted them to experience it also. So I saw it multiple times as a result of that.
That's great.
Will there be some of the tried and true things that have happened in the show that will continue to happen?
There will. We have some moments where, now, any element where airflow or items are passed over the audience, and you've seen the show a lot, so I think you know some of the things I'm referencing, we did cut out of COVID consideration, but we've brought in some really spectacular elements, and then there's a scene that that's never been done on live stage before that we're bringing into the show. But then there's a lot of, you know, the marshmallows and the paint. There's a lot of classic drumming pieces, or at least motifs that people are used to and love, that you'll also see. So my hope is that it's got just enough of both, just enough of items people love to feel like the show they know and love, and some new things to, you know, reignite their enthusiasm.
Yeah. You guys were way ahead of your time of, you know, putting shields and masks and ponchos on people. Back in the day, it was not uncommon for the first five rows to have protective covering on them from whatever might fly off of the stage at a given time.
That's right. We still have some rows that are going to wear ponchos, not because mostly paint, because we still have all the paint drumming and just to make sure that people don't go home with water soluble paint all over them. We've got some ponchos still in the first few rows.
Right. it all begins again on Wednesday at the Briar Street Theater. We'll give you information on how you get tickets, how you can learn more about Blue Man. And we'll be right back and talk more with Mary Grisolano, Managing Director of Blue Man Group, talking about Blue Man Group also returning to the Chicago area this coming Wednesday. Blue Man Group, just one of the most entertaining and creative shows that you could possibly see, is coming back. And we're happy to have Mary Grisolano with us, who is the Managing Director of Blue Man Group. For how long were you here in Chicago, Mary?
Well, I've been in Chicago in three roles, but when I was, and actually I'm from Chicago, and so I was there for 2 years back in 2000, and then moved to New York with Blue Man, and then I came back for 10. I was the business manager for a year and a half, and then this would be 9, because I was the business manager for a year and a half, and then the general manager for 7.5. So I've spent most of my Blue Man career in Chicago.
Over at the Briar Street, yeah.
Over at the Briar Street.
So it's back back home for you here, literally, mm-hmm. literally in more ways
literally.
Than one.
Yeah.
talk to me a little about the history of Blue Man. I mean, when this first started, it was just sort of this avant-garde little production, which has become a multi-million dollar conglomerate now.
Yeah, yes. It's kind of what every theater kid who says they want to start their own theater company wants, dreams of happening, right? So in the 90s, the original founders, Chris, Matt, and Phil, were sort of moved to New York, and they wanted to be involved in the art scene. And they got a group of friends together. The first major event they had was a funeral to the 80s in Central Park that MTV covered to date everybody. And then they did performance art at La Mama, which is a little New York off Broadway performing arts show, and then got a show at Astor Place Theater in New York. And actually, in 2 months, that will be 30 years ago that they opened the Astor. And you're right. Like, I wasn't around during that time because I joined the Chicago show, but people will tell stories of like how Demi Moore and Bruce Willis would come and were groupies and would hang out at the bar next door and hang out with the Blue Men. It was such a hot downtown underground New York show.
Yeah.
And then as they expanded, they realized that there was something that translated about it, that it wasn't just sort of this fringe New York, as you said, it wasn't just this fringe performance art piece. There was something that a wider audience really connected with. And the sky's been kind of the limit since then. We opened Vegas 2 months ago. We have a show in Berlin. We're going to open Chicago and Boston. And we have shows. We have a world tour that's starting in Japan in April, and a national tour that hits the markets that aren't resident shows. So, and we've had international residencies over the past 20 years. Like, it's just, there's just something very universal about it, which is
that's great. So interesting. What do you think that universal quality is that can play here in Chicago, New York, Las Vegas, and in Japan and other places around the world where the show makes as much sense in one place as it does in another?
I think that there's no language is huge, truly, because the way that they communicate is facial expressions and physicality, and a lot of it is universal, where everybody understands what they're saying. You know, we spent many years working with the autism community and doing sensory friendly shows because organically we found an audience that connected with the show because it was nonverbal, and kids and adults like it because everybody can understand it. And I also believe the music is huge. It's a very percussive, almost tribal, visceral sound that just connects with people. And then the audience interaction is fun and makes it feel like a new show every time you see it, you know, because it's so engaging and people just connect with it. So I think we've got sort of layers of very cool elements that make for something really special.
Right. I know, you know, I've enjoyed it every time that I've seen it. But, you know, I think back on one of the times I took my mom to come and see it. I said, Mom, come on, I'm going to take you to the theater. Let's go to the theater, which to her meant Oklahoma, Sound of Music.
Sure, bring it in.
Right. And, you know, we come into the Briar Street Theater and things start happening. She never stopped talking about it. She copped to the fact that she did enjoy it, but she was, you know, she was like in her 80s then, maybe upper 80s. And she was just so completely shocked at everything that was happening. Not that anything bad happens. It's just, it's just very unconventional. If you think you're coming to see the wind come whipping down the plane, it's very, very different than that.
Not that
at all. So give us the details about Blue Man Group reopening in Chicago, Mary.
Yeah, so it's reopening on August, oh my gosh, suddenly.
I think it's Wednesday, right?
Yeah, it's reopening this Wednesday.
Yeah.
And tickets are available at blueman.com. We're running shows 5 nights a week, and we expect that it's going to be a really fun time.
Yeah, and all the CDC protocols are being followed, so
that's right.
About as safe as can possibly be there. Nice to talk to you again, Mary. Thank you so much for joining us.
You too.
Mary Grisolano is the managing director of Blue Man Group. And that's going to be it for us today, boys and girls. We have a short show today because we'll have coverage of the NASCAR Cup race Verizon 200 at the Brickyard. I'm presuming not on Diversey, the other Brickyard. Is going to be coming up in just a couple of minutes here. So we will see you Monday through Friday, as always, on Bob Surratt Show between 8 and 8:30 with all the entertainment news. And, of course, on the WGN-TV morning news tomorrow, one-on-one with Hugh Jackman. How about that? Talking with Hugh Jackman about his brand-new movie. We've got some other really interesting new interviews, one-on-one with the biggest A-listers in the world, all on the WGN-TV Morning News. And we'll bring those interviews to you in their entirety next Sunday morning right here. In fact, we'll have the full Hugh Jackman interview for you next Sunday morning.